welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Frugal, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and I'm joined today by two of Bruegel's most fabulous senior fellows, Jolt Darvesh and Jakob Funk Kierkegaard. And we are going to be talking about the European Union's next seven-year budget. Over the summer, we had two major budget milestones. The Commission released its proposal for a 1.8 trillion euro seven-year budget, up from about 1.2 trillion, as I recall, in the prior version. And also, Jolt Darvesh and colleagues released a blueprint on how the EU should fix its budget process. So, Jolt, what did they do and what should they have done?
The proposal in nominal terms, as you suggested, rising from 1.2 to 1.8 trillion, sounds very impressive. But in the meantime, in the past few years, there was a major, very large inflation in the European Union as well as in the rest of the world. And also economic output measured as gross national income or gross domestic product has increased. And if you compare the budget proposal of the Commission to gross national income, then we see that it is at 1.26% of GNI, while in the preceding seven-year period, it was about 1.1. So actually, the increase is not that much, as the raw euro numbers would suggest. Moreover, as perhaps many of the listeners know, that the European Union had a lot of borrowing over the past few years, because when the pandemic hit Europe, a new instrument, which was called Next Generation EU, was launched, and this was financed by borrowing by the European Union from the markets. But such a borrowing will have to be repaid, and most of the increase in the regular EU budget would just basically use for repaying the maturing debt and the interest service of European Union debt. So if you look at how much remains for actual spending, the increase is very, very small. So in this sense, the proposal is not very ambitious, but it has some ambitious components, I have to say, and there are some components I'm very happy about it. And in fact, I think it falls short what needed, but I have to say that it exceeded my expectations, because I expected that the Commission would make a proposal much closer to the current EU budget. For example, in the current EU budget, the two major policy areas, the Common Agriculture Policy and Cohesion Policy, take up more than two-thirds of the overall spending. While in the new proposal, these two areas would be less than one-half. So there is a major reshuffling, according to the Commission's proposal, away from agriculture and cohesion toward new priorities like competitiveness, defense, research, and related areas. So I think this reshuffling is welcome. Also, in some areas such as cross-border energy connectivity, the Commission proposal wants to increase funding by about five times compared to the previous EU budget. This is also warmly welcome. So the new proposal have a number of useful elements on what to spend. However, as you kindly mentioned, we had a blueprint, a Bruegel blueprint, published ahead of the Commission proposal, in which we used first principles to lay out how the EU budget would look like or should look like in an ideal world. And what we found, for example, is that the major aspect of common EU spending should be those projects and areas where it really makes sense to spend together. Because national EU budgets, you know, spend almost half of their gross national income each year. The EU budget is just slightly over 1%, so we spend very little together from all public spending. So this little that we spend together should be really focused on policy areas where the European Union can really make a difference. And we looked at, we analyzed each item by item, the current EU budget. And for example, we found that most of the common agriculture policy, most importantly the subsidies to farmers, are not really something which should be financed from European resources, because subsidies to farmers is mostly a social policy, helping this segment of the population to have better conditions. It is enshrined in the EU treaty. The EU treaty says that the EU must have a common agricultural policy, and one goal of this policy should be to providing a decent living conditions for people in the agricultural sector. So it is in the treaty. It must be supported and financed. But the treaty doesn't say that this social support should come from the EU budget. So a much better option would have been to fully nationalize the payout of farmer subsidies to member states' budget. That would have freed up almost one third of the EU budget for common priorities like competitiveness and defense. But apparently EU members who make the actual decisions don't want to hear about it. And the Commission was also not ready to make such a proposal. So they reduced some reduction in farmer subsidies, but not that much. And it still will occupy a large share of the European Union budget. But again, the good thing is that at least there is some reallocation. So competitiveness and defense will get a much higher share.
The blueprint is called Bigger, Better Funded, and Focused on Public Goods, How to Revamp the European Union Budget. It's the Jolt and co-authors. We'll link to it in the show notes. It's really worth checking out if you're interested in this stuff. Jolt, I'm so interested that public goods is moving away from transfer payments to the newer members of the EU and to from agricultural subsidies. This is something that has been sort of a core of how the EU held together for so long. Is this as much of a shift as it feels like, that public good is moving in other directions?
According to the Commission proposal, yes, a major relative reduction is expected as a share of the overall EU budget. Now, for cohesion is also enshrined in the EU treaties, so it should be supported. And cohesion, I think, has a much greater rationale at the European level. And the reason is that cohesion actually means the richer parts of Europe supporting the poorer parts of Europe. Now, this is something that cannot be, nationalized. I mean, Bulgaria cannot help itself. I mean, look, Luxembourg can help Bulgaria, but Bulgaria cannot help itself. So I think cohesion has a greater justification. But the good news is that all of these cohesion countries are gradually converging to the richer Western partners. So while these countries still deserve, obviously, support because they are still poorer, they are not as poor as they were, let's say, 10 or 20 years ago. And I think along their convergence process, some reduction in cohesion funding is justified. And I think the Commission proposal in this regard makes a relatively reasonable balance. And at the same time, there were also lots of problems with the cohesion policy, namely whether the money is indeed used efficiently, whether it ended up just making the friends of government in each country richer and richer. So the Commission tries to control for that, and also all other institutions like the Court of Auditors and OLAF and so on. So there were lots of effort to improve the quality of cohesion spending, but there is still, I think, room for improvement there.
And can we really tease out cohesion from the Common Agricultural Policy, given the role of agriculture in all these economies?
So another notable feature of the new proposal is that the two major policies, agriculture and cohesion, will be merged together. So the Commission foresees that countries will prepare a major so-called national partnership in which they will flesh out how they would like to use both cohesion and agriculture policy and also some other policies. And in this sense, this is a useful proposal because there was also quite some overlap between the two main policy areas, not least because also agriculture policy had a so-called rural development component, and that rural development very much had the same goal as cohesion as well. So if countries would be obliged to merge the two policies, I mean, they can avoid duplications, exploit synergies. So this is overall a good direction. However, Unfortunately, there are a couple of howevers, I have to say. So whenever a country makes a major and complex comprehensive plan, its assessment would be very, very difficult. And we have already noted in our earlier research that similar plans by the Commission, similar plans by member states might not have been evaluated in the best manner by the European Commission. For example, for the Next Generation EU Pandemic Recovery Fund that I already mentioned, also EU members had to submit such plans, which were evaluated across 11 criteria. And basically, the Commission gave almost identical scores for every country. So all countries obtained a so-called grade B, so the second best for cost justification. So apparently, no EU country was able to justify cost properly. And almost all countries got a grade A for all other 10 criteria. And that's, it's simply incredible that none of the countries can justify cost well. I mean, I do think that there are differences between the capacity of administrations across European Union countries, how good they are in cost justification. So this identical score is incredible. But also when we went into more details and looked at the Commission assessment, for example, for Italy, the Commission listed several features of the Italian plan, which raised concerns about cost justification. But for Austria, even after reading three times the Commission assessment, I could hardly find one small issue that, you know, the beneficiaries list is not fully clear as a negative, but there were no other negatives. So even the tone of Commission assessment was completely different across countries, yet they all countries got the same grade. And somehow this risk that also in the new MFF, in the next one, if countries will prepare such plans, then whether it will be really objectively evaluated, that's a question mark. And another reason for concern is that these big plans makes it possible to bilateral negotiations between the Commission and EU member states, again, because of the complexity. So not every EU country can assess the plans of the other 26 countries. That's an impossible task for national administrations. So the Commission will have a major, major role. And such bilateral negotiations gives much more power to the Commission. And, you know, in some cases, the Commission might be tougher. In other cases, the Commission might be more lenient. So that's also a bit of a concern that what role the Commission is going to have and whether the quality of the plans would be sufficiently good across all EU countries.
The MFF is, of course, the multi-annual financial framework, if we didn't already say, and it will be negotiated with the Commission, the Member States, and the European Parliament over the next year or so. Jacob, you were not one of the co-authors of this blueprint, but you have done quite a bit of work on European public goods. One of the big new ones is defense, and we're also looking at other things like the long-term financial security of aging populations. How do you see those fitting in with this budget, and what's left to argue about?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's clear the Commission makes, you know, there's a lot about the so-called European Defence Union and how much money is going to be in this new seven-year budget for defence and defence-related issues. The Commission makes a big case out of it being five times as much as in the previous budget, which is true. But five times something that was very, very small in the existing budget doesn't mean that, in my opinion at least, that the European Union as an independent entity through its budget is going to play a particularly big role in European defense going forward. The reality is that defense and military expenditures will remain overwhelmingly, if not almost exclusively, at the member state level. And the money, which is up to about 130 billion over the seven-year period, is really more about budget allocations for supply chain security, critical minerals, investment in infrastructure, some funding support for military-related R&D, So, you know, when the EU talks about the defense heading in this budget proposal, it's very important to understand that it is defense defined very, very broadly. And the actual purchase of guns and bullets basically remain with member states. Something that, by the way, is also reflected in the European Commission white paper for industrial or military readiness that was also issued earlier this year. It too foresees that it is really member states that continue to play the overwhelming role in this area, both when it comes to national rearmament and also in a military sense. Even bilateral, what is more bilateral military aid to Ukraine, leaving in the coming budget proposal as well, and as well as today, the principal role, if you like, indirectly in Europe's defense is actually the increasingly dominant role the EU plays in providing financial support for Ukraine. Here, in the new budget, there is a special envelope for of 100 billion euros earmarked for Ukraine, which is basically, in my opinion, the European Commission's way of signaling to both Washington and Moscow that the accession process of Ukraine will be, if you like, fully funded. Because I think most people would operate with a likely entry period for Ukraine into the EU as a full member within the or before the 2034 expiration of the next year, the next 7 year budget. So it is not to say that the European Commission or the EU as a whole through its budget will therefore continue to play, arguably going forward, the dominant role in providing financial support for Ukraine and therefore, of course, Europe's common defense. But it will not play a particularly big role in the day-to-day planning of European rearmament and military assistance to Ukraine. On your other issue, basically paying for Europe's aging population related to national expenditures on social affairs, well, these remain overwhelmingly, of course, a member state responsibility. There is very little in the budget allocated for these purposes. And I would say the biggest role the EU plays in addressing this issue is really the constant, if you like, nudging that the EU and the European Commission's budget and structural economic reforms, European semester, medium-term policy reviews of try to nudge member states into conducting sustainability-enhancing long-term reforms of their social welfare systems, where I think it's fair to say that there are very, very large differences between member states in the financial, fiscal, long-term solidity of different European welfare states. But I would also say that if you compare Europe as a whole on this issue, there is a regular issued so-called European aging report by the Commission where they add up expected increases in, you know, healthcare, pensions, education, long-term care expenditure. In the aggregate here, European projected increases in European social expenditures are actually far lower. That is, for instance, the case in the United States and other advanced economies. But this is not, again, an issue that is meaningfully, I would say, related to the EU, the European Union long-term budget. It really is a national responsibility.
Thanks for that framing. I'm thinking very much of public goods as we consider whether agriculture is a national or a European public good, whether defense is a national or a European public good, and taking care of people fits in with that. So I'm glad to have a sense of context. Should we really see this budget as a promise that Ukraine will be a full member of the EU in the next 7 years?
In my opinion, the budget reflects that basic reality. It doesn't come from this budget. This budget is a reflection of what I would call the actual geopolitical and national security circumstances in Europe, which is that if you look at the strategy that European leaders have adopted to this war, it is increasingly a strategy, and this is very much articulated recurringly, repeatedly by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, as well as in the defense white paper from the Commission that I referenced earlier. The idea here is to, it's a so-called porcupine strategy. And the idea being that basically arming Ukraine to a large extent to be self-deterring of Russia, basically making Ukraine a sufficiently powerful military power that Russia would not want to try to invade it again. I would argue that such a strategy absolutely necessitates a level of domestic economic development and growth in Ukraine that simply requires that Ukraine as a country becomes a member of the EU. Otherwise, Ukraine will not have the capacity to sustain, also when this war eventually ends, a sufficiently large national military standing army, etc., to also provide, quite frankly, the bulk of Europe's military shield against Russia. So, and again, as I say, this budget just reflects this the basic geopolitical reality or national security reality that Europe needs as the credibility of the U.S. Security guarantee inside NATO wanes. By the way, this is not necessarily related to specifically the Trump administration, even this, if it accelerates it. This is a long-term strategic shift by the United States, perhaps also reflecting a fiscal reality in the United States, that Europe needs to be able to defend itself principally against Russia. And for that purpose, Europe needs Ukraine. And for Ukraine to play that role, yes, it needs to be a member of the EU, certainly, in my opinion, before 2034. And as a result, the budget reflects that political reality by providing 100 billion euros in a special earmarked envelope to basically finance it. So a long way of saying yes.
We spent the first half of this podcast talking about where the money is going to go out. Now it's time in the next part to talk about how the money is going to come in. Zsolt, you talk about the need for more own resources or sources of EU money in the blueprint. Right now, most of the money comes from national contributions, but there is also a growing amount of joint EU debt and also some other things like special taxes on plastics and things like that. So how does it all go together? Where are we going?
Let me start by saying that the EU budget revenues are called own resources in the EU legislation and the EU jargon, but this is a very misleading expression because the EU does not have tax-raising power in the member states, and almost everything which is called own resources are actually not owned by the EU, but provided by EU member states. So in the past decades, the most significant source of EU budget revenue was based on the national income of EU countries. So, Germany paid more in than Malta, because Germany is much, much bigger than Malta. And in a sense, this, you know, reflects the, you know, the size of the country. So I think it's a relatively fair allocation of money, and also absolutely simple, because statistical offices calculate how much national income each country produces each year. So it's relatively easy to obtain such a data and allocate the EU revenues across countries. Now, there are also other revenues currently. For example, you mentioned there is a so-called non-recycled plastic waste levy. It was introduced in 2021. So basically what's going on is that they look at each country, they look at how much plastic countries recycle and how much they don't. And based on the amount they don't recycle, EU countries pay a contribution to the European Union budget. But there are two important things here. First, this is also paid by national budgets. So national finance ministries make the transfer for this plastic waste levy to the EU. So it's not a kind of a tax that the EU imposed on whatever entities in the European Union, but this is simply just a different way of allocating income to the EU budget. So national budget finance ministries make this transfer. And secondly, it has a positive side effect, because it incentivizes countries to increase their recycling rates, because if they increase their recycling rates, they have to pay less into the European Union budget. And we know that, you know, more recycling is good for the environment. There will be, you know, less waste all around. So the main benefit, in my view, of this levy is that it brings this incentive to do something good, in this case, cleaning the environment, which is a European Union goal, and this levy helps in that way. There are also some other revenues currently. For example, the EU is a single customs union, and the customs revenues, which are collected by EU countries, most of them are transferred to the EU budget. Currently, 75% of the customs duty revenues go to the EU budget, and EU countries keep 25%. Now, the justification of this 25%, I think, is a bit shaky. Sometimes it is said that it is kept for a kind of collection cost. But, I mean, we know that, you know, collecting a tax, you know, doesn't involve a 25% cost. So it's clearly excessive. And since the EU has a common foreign trade policy, and also as a single customs area, as I already mentioned, I think there's a strong rationale for channeling all customs duty revenues to the EU budget, maybe except, again, a little cost for collection, but I think it shouldn't be more than a few small percentage points. Now, in this particular regard, the Commission makes a good proposal, because it proposed to reduce this 25% share that EU countries keep from customs revenues to 10%, which is a sizable move. It doesn't go far enough. I would have suggested keeping only 2, but at least reducing it from 25 to 10 is a good suggestion. But again, this wouldn't create a kind of new money in the European Union, because customs duty revenues were already collected. It just shares the distribution between EU countries and the EU budget. So if the EU budget will get more, then EU countries obviously will get less, and, you know, domestically they have to solve this problem, you know, either by raising domestic taxes or by cutting domestic expenditures. So there is no new money coming from the moon or from the Mars. And this is also true for all other proposals that the European Commission made in a few months ago to how to increase funding. For example, there was a proposal based on a so-called tobacco levy. So it would look at how much tobacco consumption and production are there in each EU countries. And based on that, EU countries would pay a contribution to the EU budget. Again, this would be fully paid by national budgets. So if the EU would collect revenues from this tobacco, it will be a burden on national member states. Again, this is not a new money coming from somewhere else, but just, you know, burdening more national budgets. There's also a proposal for a new levy on non-collected electronic waste. So if mobile phones or other electronic equipment are not collected, then countries would pay a contribution to the EU budget. Again, this would have a positive side effect. It would incentivize countries to increase their collection rates. So again, less, you know, electrical equipment would be in the forest and on the streets and poisoning the environment. So this is good. But again, this money would fully come from member state budget. Again, nothing new. There is also a proposal by the Commission to channel some of the revenues from the so-called European Union Emission Trading System, which basically imposes a tax on emissions by European companies. Now, currently, these revenues go to national budget. So again, if it is reallocated to the EU budget will get more, national budgets will get less. So again, national budget will face the same problem. Then they have to find additional revenues or cut expenditures domestically. So again, this is not new money at all. But nevertheless, I endorse this proposal as well, because again, So environment or cleaning the environment and the fight against climate change is a major goal of the European Union. It's a common goal. So if we can impose more taxes and burdens which penalizes emissions, that's, I think, good for the environment in general. So for these proposals that I already listed from the Commission, I'm generally positive. I just want to say the reality that this would not generate new money. It would equally burden national budgets. But there is one particular proposal which I have a major disagreement. Namely, the Commission proposed a special tax on mid-size and large companies, depending on their annual turnover. So it would not be a profit tax, which, you know, Economics 101 suggests that you should tax profit, and it says you should never tax turnover. So it would be a turnover tax. And the reason taxing turnover is a bad idea is that there are some sectors in the economy, for example, in the banking sector, the profit rate of the total revenue is around 20-25%, while in other sector, like retail, for example, the profit rate is just 2-3% or something like that. So if you impose a turnover tax, when you tax the total revenues of a company, then it will be a much, much bigger burden on profits of the retail sector, where the profit rate is low, than, for example, in the financial sector, when the profit rate is high. Moreover, we know that, you know, companies, you know, purchase intermediate products, then sell another more advanced product to another company that again does something and sell it to another company and so on. And if the turnover is taxed, it means that in all stages of these so-called value chains are taxed, and therefore the overall tax burden is cascading. Again, this is a very unfortunate and distorting impact, and could also lead to price increases. So in general, turnover taxes are very unsatisfactory and distortive. But moreover, which I also don't really understand, the Commission even proposed not a regular turnover tax, but so-called lump sum values. So a fixed amount would be paid by companies with a certain revenues. And this would mean that, for example, companies who have, let's say, 10 billion revenues, they pay the same fixed amount and a company that has only 1 billion revenue. It means that for big, big, large companies, the burden would be much, much smaller than, let's say, for mid-sized companies. So I'm afraid that this corporate tax proposal is the weakest part of the Commission's overall proposals for EU budget revenues. The other proposals are generally right, but we have to recall the reality that those will not create new revenues from Mars to the EU budget, but this will also burden national member states, and so ultimately member states will have to foot the bill of financing the EU budget.
This corporate tax proposal, would it be part of the MFF package, or would it need to be negotiated separately, because in general tax proposals have to go only to the member states, not the European Parliament, and have to be achieved unanimously?
Indeed, so there are many different pieces of legislation proposals. One is for the multi-annual financial framework, which is about spending and size. In this also, the European Parliament has a say. They must give their consent. And the other major proposal is the so-called own resources decision, which is exclusively made by the 27 countries. So the European Parliament does not have a role in that, at least formally. I mean, informally, obviously, the Parliament expresses its view. But in the actual ratification, only the 27 member states will decide how they want to allocate the financing of the EU budget among themselves.
Jacob, I have a couple of questions for you. The first question is, why would it be in member states' interest to shift some of this money to the EU budget? What do countries get out of having an EU that has more resources at its disposal?
Well, I guess in the abstract way, I mean, it comes back to this issue of delivering European public goods or basically outcomes that are beneficial to every member state, but cannot be achieved by them alone, but only by the EU together. And Zolt mentioned, for instance, this is the whole point about a customs union. For instance, it facilitates higher levels of trade among EU members, and it obviously, in principle at least, should allow the EU to negotiate better trade deals with third countries. And this same logic applies clearly, in my opinion, to Zolt already mentioned the EU's carbon pricing mechanism, the emissions trading system. Same thing. Action against climate change in Europe and the implementation of a carbon price only really makes sense at the regional level. This is not something that in an individual member state could meaningfully do, in my opinion, because it would create such large competitiveness issues that it would be politically unacceptable at the member state level. But at the national level, yes. But then the problem is, as Zolt mentioned, that currently these revenues that come in from the sale of carbon emission permits overwhelmingly goes to the member states, which, of course, was part of the deal of them agreeing to set up the system in the first place, namely that they benefited mostly from these revenues. It should be mentioned, though, that as the number of freely allocated emission permits have been reduced gradually and the European carbon price has increased in recent years, these numbers have actually, I mean, the annual revenues now are in the sort of vicinity of 40 to 45 billion euros a year. So these are, quote unquote, real money is being created through this, mostly benefiting member states. And I would also say here is a case where, from a strictly environmental point of view, in principle, the vast majority of these money from the emission trading scheme that is sent back to member states has to be used for purposes that promote climate action and energy transformation. Whether or not that's the case, we can debate in reality, but that's the principle. If you instead allocated all the money from emission trading to the EU budget, well, maybe the money would be spent on agricultural support, which I think many people would argue is not exactly commensurate with climate action, may indeed be the opposite. So looking at this, from an environmental point of view, the current system may not be necessarily environmentally worse than allocating everything to the EU level, because it ultimately depends on what the money is spent on, at the national or at the EU level. I mean, in some ways, Zsolt already mentioned that all the tariff revenues that the EU collects, most of it goes to the EU. A lot of it, 25% goes to member states. But sort of mirroring the debate that currently exists in the United States of tariff revenue as a source of government revenue, you could argue from a strictly EU budget point of view that the lack of a trade war with the United States robbed the EU budget of a significant potential source of revenue, right? This would be an economically harmful one for member states overall, but it would actually have provided revenue to the EU budget, of course, in a very, very inefficient manner overall, but nonetheless. It should probably also be mentioned that as the EU continues to pursue an aggressive free trade agreement strategy, most recently with Indonesia, it is actively moving to reduce tariffs as a source of budget revenues by simply cutting them through these bilateral deals. So there are other strategies that the EU, or policy goals that the EU pursues, that have significant implications on budget revenues and, if you like, the broader European public goods pursued through the budget. And actually here should also be mentioned, I think, coming back to emissions trading, the EU is currently scheduled to expand emissions trading to also include particularly road transportation, as well as the heating and powering of buildings, so residentials and commercial buildings, in the so-called ETS2 system that is going to be implemented in 2027, 2028. In other words, providing additional, potentially quite significant, emissions trading revenue, of which, again, a share at least goes into the EU budget. So there are, again, other policies that have budgetary implications in the next 7-year period.
There are so many trade-offs in this, aren't there, in terms of deciding what happens nationally, what happens at the European level, and how we can harness that for ideally collective good. Where do you both see the biggest opposition to these plans?
So when the Commission released its proposal in summer, basically all institutions and member states expressed concerns and resistance. The European Parliament was extremely critical. Some of their fears was, in fact, opposite to mine, because they wanted to see bigger agriculture support, while I wanted to see less, but also many other aspects were criticized. Most EU member states were similarly very, very critical. And the major thing which I expect to prevail from this criticism is the size of the EU budget. Because those countries which contribute more to the EU budget, like, you know, Germany and Netherlands and some other countries, they express that they don't have sufficient capacity domestically to pay more into the EU budget, not least because they themselves have to cut their national budgets. You know, like in Germany, for example, they plan to reduce the number of employees in the public sector by 8%, so quite significantly. And they say they can't explain their domestic voters that while they are cutting back domestic expenditures, they pay more into the EU budget. So I think the biggest sticking point will be the size of the budget, and I'm afraid that it will be reduced as a share of GNI to close to where the previous budget was.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely agree with that assessment. I mean, ultimately, and I think this is, you know, this is the historical reality of these budget negotiations, that in the end, naturally, as Zsolt mentioned, it is the countries that are the largest net contributors that have the final word. That play a disproportionate role in figuring out where the final outcome is. And they, many of them, are going to push for a reduction in the budget for the very reasons that Zolt mentioned. Sectorally, it's also, I think, a revealed historical fact that farmers in the European Union violently oppose any cuts in their the level of subsidies. Even if there are some restructuring of how agricultural support is to be channeled in this budget proposal, I think the net effect could very well be that at least some farmers will see reduced support. I would expect mobilization and, yes, violent demonstrations, manure, etc., on the streets of Brussels again. And I unfortunately would expect that to be an effective pressure tactic. It had certainly been so in the past. So I think, therefore, that there is a risk with the combination of specifically entrenched, violent pressure groups combined with the overall need from net contributing countries to cut the size of the budget, that what ends up being cut is, quote unquote, as usual, the future. That is EU support for research and development and other forward-looking investment priorities, because they do not have the same vocal slash violent interest group fighting for them. So unfortunately, I think I would probably agree with overall the sentiment that Zolt presented, namely that the final product coming out at the end of this budget negotiation process is probably going to be in the aggregate worse than the Commission's initial proposal.
Thanks for that. We're coming up on the end of our time, and I want to reflect for a minute on how much this conversation is centering on public goods and we want to provide, and relatively little on something that would have been unthinkable in the last cycle, which is the role of public debt. The Commission plan expects revenues to come in from repaying the Next Generation EU pandemic recovery debt. It is looking at using common borrowing going out to pay for Ukraine and defense and things like that. There will be a lot of debate about the levels here, but we're no longer debating about whether the EU needs a borrowing infrastructure. And I think that's a real achievement. Zolt, for my final question for you, do you think that the Commission will be successful in its bid to simplify and consolidate some of these pots of money and things? And could that be an outcome here, regardless of which way things go on the farm subsidies?
In almost every multi-annual budget negotiations in the past, the Commission came forward with proposals to simplify and streamline the whole process of budgeting, which often made some partial successes, but the truth remained that beneficiaries kept complaining that access to EU funds remains very bureaucratic and complex. Now, the Commission this time again made proposals. It seems to me that the current proposals are bolder than it was in the past, because, for example, for the competitiveness component, so which merges research and other related activities, they want to harmonize all the rules across different programs. So at least to have a single set of rules for accessing these funds. Now, if this will be successful, then indeed this could bring some relief to the beneficiaries who are actually applying. I see some prospect for this time being more successful than it was in the past, but we have to recall that such attempts in the past were naturally a great success.
With that measured comment, we have to wrap up this episode of The Sound of Economics. You've been listening to the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based think tank. You can find Zolt's blueprint with colleagues and all of our other work at our website for free, Bruegel.org. Also, the archives of this podcast here and on all your favorite podcast channels. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, joined today by Zsolt Darvas and Jacob Funk Kierkegaard. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.